You know that goal you set at the start of the year? You can still do it, whether you're committed to a thru-hike with friends, lifting heavier, or simply walking more. It's not too late to stick with it and make your future self proud, especially with the all-in-one nutrition shake from Ka'Chava. Because quality nutrition shouldn't be complicated. Just 2 scoops of Ka'Chava's all-in-one nutrition shake, and you've got 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, adaptogens, and so much more. Plus, it actually tastes delicious. No fillers, no nonsense. Just the good stuff your body craves. So instead of adding to your backstock of supplements that overpromise and underdeliver, simplify your progress with just 2 scoops of the highest quality ingredients. Stick with your wellness goals. Go to Ka'Chava.com and use code NEWS for 15% off. That's Ka'Chava.com and use code NEWS. K-A-C-H-A-V-A.com, code NEWS.
Welcome to Breaking Math. I'm your host, Autumn Phaneuf.
And I'm Noah Johnson-Kusa. Before we jump in, a quick note. The ideas you're about to hear belong to our guest as an individual thinker and mathematician. They don't represent the official views of Stanford University, the American Mathematical Society, or any other organization Ravi's affiliated with. This is simply a conversation about ideas, curiosity, and the human side of mathematics. Speaking of curiosity, today we're joined by Ravi Vakil, the Robert Grimmett Professor of Mathematics at Stanford University and current president of the American Mathematical Society. Ravi is an algebraic geometer whose work ranges from beautifully abstract questions in geometry to results with names as mischievous as Murphy's Law. Alongside his research, he's deeply committed to teaching, mentorship, and expanding access to mathematical discovery, from founding programs that nurture young mathematicians to helping build communities where mathematical thinking thrives. In short, Ravi is someone who doesn't just study mathematics. He helps shape how it's learned, shared, and lived. So let's begin. All right, so Ravi, let's start by hearing what makes you most passionate about mathematics or the mathematics profession.
Great. I guess for me, definitely it starts with the mathematics. So it's what's beautiful. And so that guides a lot of other things which seem like they might be primary. But for me, it's just what's amazing about nature and beautiful about it. And then that relates to why people matter in it as well. Because if something's incredibly beautiful, you want to both share it with people and also the way in which you create it is with people as well. So that's what's always been, that's something when you're really tiny, when you see beautiful things that you just want make you happy and squeal with joy. It's the same thing you get to be happy about decades later, and you always want to share them with other people and hear about them from other people.
So beauty is tricky to define in art, and I would say it's just as tricky, if not trickier, in mathematics. What does beauty mean for you in math?
So beauty is tricky in art, and it's tricky in mathematics, but the amazing thing is that we agree on it so much that if you get a bunch of people in a room and they're open to seeing something beautiful, they tend to agree in it. Maybe in art, it can be more complicated sometimes, but somehow in mathematics and in science, I feel like it's sometimes easier where somehow an entire room can have an aha moment at the same time. Or when you're sharing a drink with someone or a coffee with someone and you hear something amazing or you get to say something amazing, everyone's eyes light up at the same time. So it is somewhat cliche to say, you know, when you see it, but there are some commonalities that are always there. There are things that make your blood beat faster, that make you, the word epiphany is a phrase that mathematicians say and really feel, and that feels a little bit religious as well. When something so amazing happens that you remember years later when you first heard it. So I think there is this commonality, and that's that developing of mathematical taste and appreciation that we can agree on even if we can't really describe where it happens. But it really accompanies where things are powerful. And somehow when suddenly you see the Grand Canyon, you don't just see something beautiful, you also see something very far away. Or when you climb an amazing mountain, then you have a view as well as you've exerted yourself, but you've also achieved something and you see farther than other people do as well. That somehow it opens your eyes when you happen to understand it.
Now, what I'm looking at is if we're taking things beautifully, whether it's in nature and having epiphanies, what happens now that we're getting into tech a lot more? We're diving into AI, data, and algorithmic decision-making. Are we going to lose our humanity a little bit as mathematicians?
I think there's always the danger when you get distracted by superficialities and you miss the essence of things, then absolutely you can lose the beauty. And there's a loss there because you'll be far less an effective thinker once you lose that as well. So I don't think there's any real need to lose the beauty, but there is a real danger of it. When one danger mathematics has that other things that inspire beauty don't have is that it's desperately useful and needed. And so many people feel the need to know it because it's so valuable. And because it has this utilitarian side that I think the beauty can be lost. But the people who have the most powerful ideas tend to be those who can best see the beauty in it. So somehow, even if you want to gain the power of what this point of view has, you're led to try to appreciate what makes the idea simple, what makes them beautiful. So absolutely, there's a danger there. And you see it in schools a lot of the time. You see it in the media a lot of the time. But it really is not inherent to the subject. It's something we have to constantly fight against.
So let's push deeper in this, because I think it's really interesting. See, you've talked about what people find beautiful, the taste, this kind of shared experience of epiphany, of aesthetics and mathematics. It's very much on the human-centric side. So to kind of develop further what Autumn was asking, as AI comes in and is involved in the mathematical research process and who knows what ways, creativity, vetting, you know, all kinds of things, do you think AI integrated math will have the same aesthetics? Is it going to have that same universality? Could it drive us in other directions? You know, everything you described was so much about the human experience. So to kind of push what Autumn was saying, what if AI takes us in a different direction? Or do you think it will or won't?
I mean, so anytime there's a new technology, it opens up new possibilities. I'm an optimist, but not an idiot. So when it comes to what becomes possible, currently creativity seems not so much on the table. It really seems to assist us a great deal. But when photography became possible, it did change visual art. Did it ruin it by suddenly making photorealism possible? No. There was a completely new variant of what came before. And perhaps it was predictable, perhaps it was not. There were pioneers, there were people who experimented with it. There were people who deliberately tried things that didn't, and that ended up not working. There are people whose names we remember decades later. I see no reason for this to be any different. When computers came to science and to mathematics, it really did change what we were able to do, but it didn't get rid of curiosity and creativity at all. It just gave us tools with which to do them. It's true that certain questions became less interesting. Certain kinds of art become differently interesting once certain technical problems go away, for example. So photorealism may get rid of certain kinds of art, but yet we do see paintings where you get this incredible detail that looks essentially photographic. So I see no reason for it to completely upend how things go, but certainly it'll be transformative. Every time there's been a new technology, it's being transformative. And it's always been a bit traumatic as well. But it's always tended to work out all right, although there are casualties.
With some of those casualties, and as we're seeing these changes, are there some mathematical ideas that you think deserve more attention in this climate than others? Because AI is changing that landscape. And even if some of these ideas aren't particularly fashionable, they might be important.
Right. I think important ideas tend to become fashionable. So often there's beauty in things that are important that people don't realize until after the fact. Some things become important only once they become easier, once technology makes them easier. So I do think there are some things that there are questions related to large amounts of data that were perhaps not so interesting a few decades ago because they were theoretical, and now suddenly they're absolutely fascinating because we can really get into their guts. Maybe they're also fascinating because they have the ability to do great good and great evil. And understanding them well allows you to do potentially great good, but potentially great evil. And so it's going to attract a lot of people to think about those questions. And also the questions will become more interesting because suddenly we can zoom into them and look at them up close. And of course, the question becomes more interesting if it directly affects the lives of billions of people in a direct hands-on way rather than just simply being something which is absolutely beautiful. So the ideas which led to these things happening were very theoretical, and now they're frankly very practical.
What about the community of people doing mathematics? Do you see AI and other tools broadening that, where maybe someone who didn't spend so many years learning so much foundational mathematics can kind of jump in and use the tools to get a boost? Do you see the community being overrun by AI-produced stuff that makes it really hard to find the signal and the noise? How do you see the community response?
So I think there are two sides to this coin that are really very different. Maybe I'll start with the positive just because it's more pleasant, which is that every time technology has really affected mathematics, the ones that have really had a big effect on mathematics are maybe ones that would surprise most people if they haven't thought about it, which is that, which comes to the fact that mathematics is really a particularly social subject, which is opposite to what people think, because it's a very hard subject. It's very hard to understand. And what that means is the best way for a human being to understand it is to talk with other human beings. That's why we have to be together at a blackboard, in a room together, ideally, to try to communicate something where it comes best. You try to read something on a page because it's better than nothing. But better than that is being with a human being, which is why being in the same place, which is why when there are funds to pay scientists to do things, for some scientists, you pay for huge machinery. For mathematicians, you pay them to be in the same room together. And the technologies that made a big difference for science and for mathematics are really things that you could describe as social, or if you want to say different, like network effect. So historically, what are the things that really turbocharged mathematics? Well, if you go way back, it would be when the printing press arrived, or even further back, when books could be passed around in monasteries, or when intellectuals, when there's enough food surplus, when intellectuals could live a life of the mind, there'd be a small number of people in certain cities around the world who could talk together and discuss things. And then there were universities and colleges, and the university lecturer was designed. And then suddenly people could be in the same city and ask questions to each other. Or I think one thing which people don't appreciate is having a big making a big difference was the post. People would write letters to each other. And that changed the speed at which people had ideas. And the internet was important, not just because we could write code, but also because people could talk to each other thousands of miles away in real time. The telephone made a big difference. The carbon copies made a big difference. All the things that made the biggest difference are actually social in nature. And every time some sort of technology happened, there was a speed up because people could learn faster. They could think faster. I guess you could go way back and say writing sped up mathematics because you could suddenly have this external storage device for your thinking. And you can communicate with other people who are not physically in the same place as you. So every time in the past, I'm trying to think of an exception when technology made a really big difference. I guess simply being able to code on your own is something which is very solo. But everything else involves network effects where you could educate large numbers of people. When suddenly large numbers of human beings could go to school, then you could pull talent from more and more parts of society. The kinds of people who went to school started being pulled from not just some very narrow part of society. Suddenly you had huge numbers of people who could, you're tapping into huge numbers of human minds who could work together. So one could expect that where AIs will be helpful will be in this. What they already do is they collate human knowledge. But if they isolate us, and I don't worry about that because those who just listen to AIs and don't learn how to think from other human beings are just going to be less successful at doing science, at doing mathematics. So that's the positive side. The negative side is also there, which is that huge amounts of really, frankly, crappy everything can be produced at scale. And it's flooding our journals. And it's, I think, completely analogous to maybe on social media. On paper, social media is a fantastic thing. It can connect us all. But it also can be this toxic sludge pit. And it can slow things down because you just get sucked in, lose the signal for all that noise. And I think this feels a little bit like when you talk to this is a good metaphor for talking to an AI, because if you don't know how to do it wisely, I think it's going to end up pulling a lot of people away from thinking clearly. So that's the negative side as well. So the winners will do much better. The people who are fortunate and have higher social capital and learn how to think well will really benefit from this. And I fear that a large number of people who will lose the chance to learn on their own because they can simply go to a computer and ask it to do the work for them will not be able to think as well. So I think that's the dark side.
You did mention that journals are being flooded, and I didn't even think to ask that because I thought that's more of like a fear of the future, but are you saying that we're already seeing this now?
It has begun.
I see.
I do think it's going to get much worse, but it has already begun. The submissions, now it's not so bad. I think we'll look at this as the good days, because the sludge that'll come in over years will be tuned to try to fool us as much as possible. Just like spam is designed to spool us, to fool us more and more and more. And it's going to damage human trust because, well, to give an explicit example, there's a question of, so here's something perhaps in the weeds, maybe too much in the weeds, but there's a question
when you...
Great, I'll go into the weeds, which is when people submit papers to journals, you could ask, should the referee know who the author is or not? And analogous to that is when people audition for orchestras, should you see the person or hear them behind the screen? And it's not a perfect analogy. I don't think it's a perfect analogy because when they did this, suddenly you had a much more diverse group of people who were picked for orchestras because it was purely based on the sound and not on the expectation of what they look like. And for very good reason, there's a movement to try to make it blind to the referees as to who the authors were. However, if there is going to be AI slop coming, then a very first cut as to whether it's slop or not is, do I know that there is a human being? Is there a known human being behind it? And that makes a difference. So it right now, I really would not want to read 100 random papers or be exposed to 100 random papers of which 95 might be designed to try to fool me that I would even call. I think the authors aren't being malicious, but I see it as malicious. They don't understand the mathematics. They don't understand the ideas. What they're doing is going to waste my time. And so that's a little bit certainly in the weeds, but I think that's potentially going to damage how we do science and slow down everything because without peer review, without human, once again, you need humans in the system. There have been idiots who propose letting AIs do the selection of who gets funded for science and government. What gets published, who gets hired. This is based not on any evidence, but only on wishful thinking. But it's very dangerous thinking because they're going to make the wrong decisions as they have repeatedly. And so anything that throws sand into the gears of humans working together does, as social media is experiencing this right now. And now professional journals are experiencing as well.
You know that goal you set at the start of the year? You can still do it. Whether you're committed to a through hike with friends, lifting heavier, or simply walking more, it's not too late to stick with it and make your future self proud, especially with the all-in-one nutrition shake from Ka'Chava. Because quality nutrition shouldn't be complicated. Just 2 scoops of Ka'Chava's all-in-one nutrition shake, and you've got 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, adaptogens, and so much more. Plus, it actually tastes delicious. No fillers, no nonsense. Just the good stuff your body craves. So instead of adding to your backstock of supplements that overpromise and underdeliver, simplify your progress with just 2 scoops of the highest quality ingredients. Stick with your wellness goals. Go to Ka'Chava.com and use code NEWS for 15% off. That's Ka'Chava.com and use code NEWS. Ka'Chava.com, code NEWS.
Is really dangerous.
I've also seen this happen with a couple of my colleagues, and that dynamic is changing because when someone's publishing a lot more, they have had actually some of their papers almost copied word for word, and you can tell whether or not it's AI. And this has been popping up. So I wonder if that's also trickling down into the humanities. Because
I'm not qualified to speak knowledge about it, but I would be absolutely worried and terrified that it's coming whether they realize it or not. I might expect that the early adopters might be in the sciences, but the bad actors are spread throughout. I think that the intellectual, it's very dangerous in the humanities because that's a place where the new ideas come from humans, and the fake new ideas look very convincing. AIs write already very well in a humanistic way. Already, it's very tough to help. How do you learn how to think? You learn how to think by writing well. This is true whether you're a scientist or a humanist or just a general citizen. That it's important to know how to write to convince people. And how do you learn how to do something? Do it by practicing. And now we can no longer have young people with confidence go and write on their own for many hours on their own, because it's hard to tell what the result is. You need to have some young person, particularly stout of heart, who will really learn well under those circumstances. And then the evaluations will inevitably be short form blue books. It's the same way that we have multiple choice tests, not because they are fantastic at measuring learning, but because they are good at measuring learning given the constraints of needing to check really quickly. And they're a good proxy, but they're highly imperfect. And now we'll have to do the same thing with writing. And already we see that people are not used to reading long form anymore. And once we break that, there's a certain kind of thinking we're going to lose once people lose the ability to hold your attention for many hours. And I should say, bringing it back to being a mathematician, an important part of producing mathematics is the ability to concentrate for a long period of time. One thing that being a mathematician does is it helps you learn how to concentrate for a long period of time on something. And that is, there are virtues in that. There are virtues in whatever gets you to do that, being meditation or reading long novels or concentrating on an experiment for a long period of time, or digesting a deep mathematical thought. All of these things are useful things which can be potentially aided by technology, but disrupted by making certain sorts of things that let us practice. The practice, which helps us develop these skills, can be disrupted by making certain things too easy.
Now, personally thinking about the balance and depth between mathematics and when this is meeting the public sphere, it doesn't matter if that's AI or not. Where do we find this balance going forward? You mentioned blue books, which takes me back to Catholic school days with nuns and having to do all of the lines in the books. So where are we going for accessibility, essentially, whether that's learning in the classroom or even communicating mathematics?
It feels like we're still moving back to the heart of human interaction, where hundreds of years ago, we talked to each other in small groups. And there was all the rage not too long ago about how massive online courses were going to be the wave of the future. There was the wave 5 years ago, until the pandemic came and destroyed this aspiration, that the way to go, the way we would always be forevermore, was we would just live on a screen with many other people. And this would be much better, and it would save so much money over actual in-person human interaction. And it's completely true that human interaction is expensive. Bespoke, small group interaction is expensive. It's why colleges, at least for the well-to-do, will always look the way they currently do. And it's sad that what's going to happen, depending on which country you live in, is that probably, depending what zip code you're in, you'll end up not getting that human interaction because it'll be considered not worth it for you. Instead, you'll be on a screen and you'll be in a very large room with lots of people. But the way forward is the way it's always been, which is we talk to each other. And that's why education is expensive. That's why you're not going to see vast cost savings over time on childcare for small children or education for university students, because things that cost human time are not things that are so easily, you could nickel and dime on them, but you're going to pay the price on the other end. Education, I feel like this is such an old story that education is expensive compared to the alternative. That's obviously true, but every single year we come back to this again and again and again as we try to save money on this. So I think the blue books, the small seminars, the talking to people, the meeting friends for coffee in small groups, it's not this, I feel like you cannot substitute for that. Even if you have 1,000 friends and you're in online, it's just not the same, even if those friends you're with are not as carefully curated, they're not as knowledgeable, they're not, somehow you're good, the people who are have the good fortune of learning, of really working in small groups. That's how the best graduate students, the best graduate student experience always happens. Why does graduate school work this way? It still works the way it always did, because you need small groups of people to work together. It's not quite apprenticing, but you need to be in the same room. Or if they're away, now happily my students can be hundreds of miles away, but I know them very well because they've been in the same room with me a lot. There's a human interaction. And there's no one has found a way to economize on this. No one, people have theorized, but it's There's no evidence that we can skimp on human interaction and end up with a better result.
So, Ravi, you've been talking a lot about this human connection about mathematics, the human interactions. Earlier, we talked about the aesthetics, this artistic aspect. You've talked about kind of a fortitude growing, almost religious devotion to mathematics, how it can help you develop character and skills. Let me put out kind of a thought experiment. So let's imagine a few years in the future where large language models or whatever variant we're using at the time can just, let's say, semi-autonomously produce mathematics papers at scale. So now we can just generate, I don't know how many are published each year, but let's say thousands and thousands or tens of thousands of math papers every month. And let's say there are correct statements, proofs of theorems and things. How will that, how do we know if that's good or bad? How does that actually change the world? Or another way to say it, is producing more theorems and more papers the only measure of success in math? And if not, how do we know when we're doing better at math? Just because we have more math may not mean we have better mathematics.
Well, I'm somewhat leery of thought experiments, but I enjoy them anyway. So I feel like predicting 5 years in the future is great too, but shouldn't be taken too literally.
All right.
Because of the uncertainty involved. But if computers could produce a large number of things that are currently papers, that would just mean I don't think that's what papers will look like in the future. If that makes certain kinds of thinking easy, then that's not where we'll be spending our attention. We'll still have the same goals, which is to understand new things better. And we'll just understand new things better faster. And so maybe the papers should plausibly be that the mathematicians of that time, of the near future, the people who are currently 15 years old, they'll have a deep understanding of a broad number of fields and be able to deliberately, quickly go deep into something. It won't be at the tip of their tongue. But with the assistance of the AIs, they'll say, I bet something like this is true. Their taste will be excellent. That's the thing that they cannot acquire from that they'll have to learn on their own, assisted by AIs, but thanks to their exquisite taste, they'll say, I think something like this should be true. Then the AI will guide them through it to tell them how to think. They'll say, then I want to do this, then I want to do that. And the AI will be a prosthetic that'll let them do things in just the same way that in the past, there used to be papers that would be devoted to understanding the structure of numbers, calculating digits of pi was something interesting and important because it had technological consequences. That's completely uninteresting right now because it's a solved problem that technology does better than humans. I think it'll just change what we do. And to assume, we always assume that the future is going to look like just now. If you read the predictions of the future from maybe 70 years ago, the predictions for today would be flying cars. Well, the flying cars are not here. But the reason they thought about flying cars, they thought about what they had, and they simply made it fly. And our imagination about the future tends to be flying cars and not about the internet. And so what really will change will be, it won't be a version of today. Certain things will fade and die on the vine, and other new things will become more central. So I can imagine it's different, but the goal will still be, the goal now is human understanding, is to advance understanding of nature. The goal 100 years ago was exactly the same. They didn't have computers. They were doing it. They're having fantastic ideas with what they knew. We have technology. We're doing, frankly, a fantastic job with what we know as well. I don't think the plan has really changed. We just have to get used to the fact that when we're grumpy old men, as opposed to grumpy, whatever we are right now, grumpy old women as well. But I think you're less likely to be grumpy, Autumn, than we are. We're going to be the...
Autumn's never grumpy. On camera. Off camera, different story.
Off camera is very different.
But I think we have to get used to the fact that old people tend to be grumpy because the world has changed a lot. And I already feel myself beginning to feel, I don't want to, but it's going to happen because the way people will do mathematics will be different. They'll have superpowers that I won't natively speak. In fact, my entire field of mathematics went through a revolution, and this is Noah's field as well. The revolution came in the 60s or so, and everyone who was from before that time, except for a few farsighted people, they were just put out on an iceberg and set out to sea. And it was, you know, in some sense sad for them because the revolution came. Revolutions will continue to come, and life will be good, but it won't be our world. It'll be the world of.
This is why we have grumpy old professors.
One of the reasons.
One of the many, many reasons. Many. But we don't need to talk about departmental politics at all.
Well,
What you're saying, Ravi, makes me think of a point. I'm going to sort of editorialize, but I've seen a lot of chatter on social media lately that AI is solving a lot of these Erdos problems and solving all these things. And I just really want to make the point, so again, either of you are welcome to disagree or agree or whatever, that I would say in mathematics, the reason why we're drawn to these really hard open problems, these conjectures, isn't actually because those problems are important. It's because they somehow are indicating we are missing some key insight, some definition, something is missing in our mathematical foundation. And often solving the problem is really meaningless, but the problem is saying, look, this is something we should be able to solve. And the fact that we can't means we haven't understood something. So this is kind of, I'm thinking of this based on what you're saying, that getting an AI to technically solve a lot of these hard problems may not be so important if it just says, yes, it's true, or provides some solutions that doesn't provide that insight. And hopefully we will get the insight, but I do want to say that solving a problem versus learning is not always the same thing.
What's super interesting about what you're saying is the fact, which I think is really true, that a lot of discussion about when things happen in the media is they're misunderstanding the difference of when a human solves a problem versus when the AI solves a problem. Some things, it's super interesting when the AI solves a certain kind of problem for the first time. It is much less interesting when an AI solves a certain kind of problem the second time. I've seen cars go from 0 to 60 in so many seconds before. So to see it again is not that exciting. So the entire purpose of the good problem you give a human being when they're in 10th grade to solve, I'm just not that impressed when a machine can do it, because the entire purpose of it is to hone the human's mind. It has a different purpose. And similarly, an exercise in a textbook or a problem for a young person, all of these things are to train a person to think. And I am excited to see what AIs can do. And I really do find it exciting to find out where the frontier is. But that's why it's always important to have experts in the room to say, this is interesting for this reason. It's not that the singularity is coming next week, because I'm a little tired of it coming next week. I've been waiting a long time for my pina colada beach, you know.
Your abundance.
Exactly. Or to, you know, I've been waiting to become a slave to our new overlords. And it's not. Neither has come. No one reasonable is surprised. And I think I think what you're saying is completely true.
Now, I'm curious, as we're shifting the climate with AI, with technology, what does leadership look like in mathematics as we're going forward? Because this is a global discipline, but institutions, funding, mobility are not. Where are we going in the next few years? How can we become better leaders?
I think there needs to be some historical understanding that things aren't as to stay as they are today. They weren't always as they are today. We are in a period of unprecedented advances and prosperity, and it didn't come from nowhere. And if you go back to, the right decade would be around the 90s and 30s and 40s, intellectual leadership in the world was in Germany. And it was not in Germany certainly as of 1947. And things change, and they change for reasons. There are huge investments in education in different countries that have essentially always paid off. I guess there plausibly are exceptions, but I can't think of them. The United States invested a huge amount in science and education and in thinking in an undirected way. And so I think leadership is paying attention to the importance of these kinds of thinking. And this involves what opportunities we have for kids who are 5 years old, 10, 15, but also 20. And also it involves how we think of science and whether we kill the goose that laid the golden eggs. We are cashing out. There's a lot of discussion of how technological change might lead to serious damage to the future of the sciences, but the actual damage comes from that is happening in real time in ways that the evidence is present on government websites, is on the actual reduction in funding for basic science. We currently can't do basic science in this country the way we could not too many years ago. And that's a choice. And the great thing about it is it's not going to cost us that much for a while. The real cost doesn't come for a while until the generation that would have come through doesn't turn up. The thing about education is the benefit is not immediate. It does not, you can't put $9 billion into NSF funding and get $20 billion out the next year. You have to actually wait a few years and then you get much more out. So if you want to cash out, it's a great way to cash out, but the price we'll pay is later. What's an interesting exercise to do, and I did this exercise, I used to often ask this as a thought experiment, even though I said I didn't like thought experiments, but it's worthwhile doing it because you see what the stakes are. I looked back and I asked this around 2005 and around 2010, so long predating the current moment, which is to try to guess what are the most important universities going to be in the world in 40 years or in 30 years? What countries will be dominant? And if you ask different audiences, they'll have different answers. And I guess people in the audience, in your audience, will have different answers to what they would be. And the interesting thing is, if you look back in time, it was really quite different in the not too distant past. So I'm in California. I'm originally from Canada. So I noticed the change in California, maybe more than people in California do. But California was not always a thought leading part of the world. In fact, the universities in California were not major universities on a global level, even in the middle of the 20th century. So something changed. And right now, for example, the UC system in California, due to decades of investment, all are extremely strong universities. Merced is the weakest because it's up and coming. It's the youngest and it's on its way up. And every single one is remarkably highly ranked. But also the Cal State system and community college system is designed to bring millions and millions of smart kids up through and into whatever they want to. Prosperity, should it be, or education? So how did that change? What was that investment and who benefited? And the interesting thing is California did benefit. A huge amount of money went into these schools. And it is true that lots of the kids left the state. So maybe it was a vast waste of money to invest money in all these kids because so many left the state. But so many did not. And so many came to the state. And the net, it's clear financially that it was a net benefit. So it's an interesting thought experiment. What do you think the major universities were in 1950? Then go back in time and actually check. And you might be surprised to see the ones that have faded and the ones that have risen. And then you can ask yourself, how did that happen? And then ask yourself, what's happening in the next 10 years? And an interesting thing is living at a fortunate university and thinking about where students go to graduate school and where students are coming from, you can see this change in real time that universities in other countries, some are rising incredibly rapidly. Others are fading. The fades are always slow. The fades tend to be slow, but the rises can be rapid. And it's really interesting to watch. What's stopping joining that rise? Well, it's just nothing more than its willpower, its willingness to invest. It does cost money, but so who's investing that money? And then those are the places you want to bet on in the world.
What about the balance between math and other disciplines? There seems to be a sort of social or economic pressure to really go all in on technology, computer science, mathematics. Do you think that's the right approach? Do you think more liberal arts, very balanced, is the right approach? How do we navigate that?
So I think there's a temptation, there's like a cognitive error people make with education where they see the benefits of education. And one of the benefits of education is prosperity. And then a lot of people would just say, that's fantastic. Let's just cut out the middleman. We don't need to invest in anything leading up to it. Let's just put money into that very last stage. And so people see Silicon Valley and say, I want that where I live. And so they will want to say, let's just have a university that just concentrates on these small few things. If you look at what happened in the 1960s in the United States, terrified by Sputnik, the United States poured huge amounts of money in education. And that education absolutely went heavily into science and technology, but it went into everything as well. There's a huge expansion across the board. It's true there was more in technology than elsewhere, but the humanities really succeeded. And if you look at the really major universities in this country, there are some exceptions, but the exceptions are less than you might think. They tend to be strong across the board because you tend to want, this is more the American style of education than the European. You have smart young people coming, not knowing completely what they want to do. And they come thinking they want to do something and they end up wanting to do something else. And so you want them coming to You want them coming to college. They're smart. They don't know what they want to do. They meet someone. They think they're going back home to their home country or home state. They meet someone. They settle down. They start a family. They think they're doing one thing. They do something else. A bunch of them start businesses. Others become teachers. Others become scientists. And success happens. And so Silicon Valley happens. All these areas around universities, there's no miracle. It's not just the technology parts, although that is a part of it. The research triangle is fantastic, and technologically, it's amazing. But those colleges are really good across the board. Those are fantastic colleges in all sorts of fields. And if you said, let's strip them down to the essentials and just do tech, though, the research triangle would no longer be what it is. Silicon Valley, Stanford and Berkeley dropped their strengths in the other subjects and didn't pride themselves on being among the best in the world across the board. It would damage them as institutions. And I think the example someone might give would be places like Georgia Tech and MIT. If you look closely at MIT, MIT is actually very strong. It's true that it emphasizes some fields and it has less of others, but even in across the board, it is an extremely strong, it's intellectually extremely strong. It is not a narrowly focused school. So not there tends not to be, at least in the United States, the way forward has not been to be narrow. In fact, currently the success is to be broad and smart. And if you really believe that you want a strong tech sector, you want to produce huge numbers of smart young people. So why, you could ask yourself, why is the University of Michigan a really strong school and other large states do not have correspondingly strong schools? Well, the secret is that the car industry was based in Michigan. And so they were politically influential. They were key to making sure the state paid for public education so they could have huge numbers of smart, cheaply produced engineers, and they went to the races with it for decades. And now that things are fading somewhat, the school has invested enough that it can stay a strong school. So this is all a case for broad, everyone does not need liberal arts education, but a liberal arts education needs to be available for everyone. It's not that every single person should have the same education, but being narrow collectively is never being a good bet.
So you talked about the liberal arts. What advice would you give to someone who loves math, but feels that they don't belong, or someone who has stepped away from mathematics and said, I'm not able to understand it and it's too much?
So if someone says you don't belong, then definitely don't listen to them. Mathematics is unfortunately has driven out too many people in many ways. But also the flip side is it's a place where there are enough strange and weird people that it's also accepting of a lot of unusualness as well. So you'll see a lot of, I mean, there's, I'll put it as tactfully as possible, but mathematicians can vary quite a lot. And so the main thing is to be comfortable and find beauty and don't listen to it when people say you have to stay on a royal road in order to understand and enjoy mathematics. That's just not true. Also, you should have a big sense of the subject. You should realize it's large, not narrow. It's connected to many things. It's the most connected of subjects. It's sort of the stem cell from which other subjects have historically sprung out of. So it's a great place to come into if you're interested in something else. And it's a great place to wander out of because people often realize they're math people and then they are really fascinated in physics, and really it becomes a real advantage to someone, you know, economists who are mathematically very talented, of which there are quite a number. It gives them superpowers. Or if you're a biologist or computer scientist or a physicist, or really anything, you can take from it what you find best, and you should choose what you find best. The main thing is don't listen to people who tell you something exclusionary about it, because it just empirically doesn't make sense. There's so much to it, and the most important thing is this powerful way of thinking, which has this aesthetic component and this ability to see things that other people can't see. And the joy in seeing those things and that aha moment is the thing that really matters.
Today's episode was a great reminder that math is really about curiosity, people, and the ideas connecting us. I hope this episode gave you something new to think about and maybe spark. Ravi, thank you so much for coming on the show. Today's episode was a great reminder that math is really about curiosity, people, and the ideas that connect us. I hope this episode also gave you something new to think about and maybe a spark to explore something a little deeper. Thanks so much for spending time with us. And if you enjoyed the conversation, subscribe to our Substack and follow us on social media so you don't miss what's coming next. And as always, stay curious and stay informed of the world around you. Until next time.